Can Europe survive? Does it deserve to? That's the question we asked in the first ever live audience event for the Another Europe podcast with Ash Sarkar from Novara Media, Gian Giacomo Migone, a former member of the Italian Senate and a prominent 1968er, and another 1968er, Mary Caldor from the LSE. Enjoy. So, we're going to start by asking, and this is a question for everybody, but I'm going to start with Gian Giacomo. In terms of the origins of the EU, most of the arguments we make are about its peace and reconciliation agenda. But has that been borne out, and is it a realistic thing to base a political project on?
Yes and no is the answer. Europe, having been for centuries the generator of wars, and the generator of the two world wars of the previous century, we have moved away from that. And I think the construction that has ended up in the European Union has been very relevant from that point of view. The no, I think, is equally obvious, that the price that has been paid for this achievement is to start with the economics, with the coal and steel community, then the common market, and then Maastricht. Maastricht was important in terms of a moving together of the Europe as a whole, also after the fall of the Berlin Wall. But it was also a Europe of the bankers, a Europe that fortified, the strengthened, the sort of neoliberalism that is the fundamental element of inequality today. This also has political consequences, because if the very privileged few can move capitals, can move industries, can move people just with a click, can safeguard their immense fortunes, this translates itself into an attack, a sort of rape on democratic institutions, because anyone who is in a position of responsibility, public responsibility, has to choose between the common interests and this sort of situation in which on paper they are responsible for powers that no longer exist. So the bottom line is either we move ahead and we make the European Union an instrument for empowering the people, or else the situation is going to be worse and worse.
Ash, I know you've got a critique that kind of predates Maastricht, and it's more about the colonial baggage of Europe. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, so I was joking with both Zoe and Luke before I started that I'm the closest thing to a Lexeter that you have on this panel, and not actually a Lexeter. What I have is a sort of set of critiques which often have been, I think, sidelined, even in, you know, radical Remainy circles. There's this idea of, well, we'll deal with those critiques after we accomplish the mission of stopping Brexit or da-da-da-da-da. Whereas I think that we've got no hope of reviving democratic faith in the European Union without addressing these critiques head on. And maybe you don't end up at renewed democratic faith in the European Union if you go through these critiques, but I think it's necessary to do so. But saying all that, I think it's important to look at the European Union, its relationship not just to coloniality but decolonization, I think, is the more important part to think about here, and thinking about the way in which, you know, that period of the 40s, 50s, in the 60s was one of massive destabilization of the former colonial powers, is that you don't be so decolonial that you avoid the territory of the situation that we're in right now, which I think is something that can happen from this particular point of view. It seems to me that the European Union as a political project, and not just a political project, but a project of, you know, shared political identity and cultural being, has at its heart, as well as trying to resolve the conflicts that Europe experienced internally, a way of evading, I think, its colonial heritage and also its ongoing colonial relationship to the global south, particularly in terms of uneven trade, of the exploitation of labour and of resources. One of the things that I keep coming back to and thinking about is that aid agreement that was reached between the EU and Afghanistan a couple of years ago, in which a package of aid, which was, you know, desperately needed in a country that's been, you know, bombed to bits by European countries plus America, was tied to expedited deportation of Afghans from the EU. And so this question of what does Europe owe the global south, it's not a historical question at all. It's not about us going back to, you know, 1919 and the Amritsar massacre. It's looking at the conflicts that have occurred through the 90s, through the war on terror, and thinking about how the ongoing existence of Europe, its political identity, is tied not just to those conflicts continuing, but this quite violent project of, I think, forgetting and erasure and trying to distance oneself from the costs of that conflict.
Mary, how would you answer that?
I think, actually, we had this discussion before, me and Ash, but Ash is, I think, that the way Ash presented it, I have a lot of agreement with it. I think it is true that at the origins of the European Union, there was both the left, who wanted a socialist Europe, and we've talked about the Ventotene Manifesto by Spinelli and others, which was a manifesto for a socialist Europe. And I know I was brought up by a Hungarian father who really believed in a united socialist Europe. And there was the whole peace project, but there were also many people in the European establishment, including actually Churchill, who really wanted to pool the colonies and create a new kind of European superpower. And I think there's actually a conflict that goes on between these two aspects of Europeanism that is very much, I'm going to talk about it in the next session, that is very much reflected in its external policy towards, because there is a contradiction between the neoliberal policies related to aid and to trade, and then a lot of the policies, the EU I think is the biggest aid donor in the world, leaving, even excluding all the individual EU countries' aid.
Oh, really?
So, and you know, things like, people don't often know, like the Palestinian Authority is entirely funded by the European Union. So in a way, there's an awful lot also going on about the Europeans' role as, you know, having an external security policy similar to what the United Nations does in promoting human rights and so on. So there's a huge contradiction which reflects the contradiction of politics.
Yeah, yeah.
And I sort of feel our role is to push for this different human rights-based role, even though we're very aware. And I think it's kind of paradoxical that Maastricht itself represented that contradiction. We had a lot of talk earlier today about post-68. And post-68 brought two different reactions to the state. One was the one that Hillary so eloquently described, transformation of the state, a whole series of interests in rights of various kinds, whether we were talking about gender equality, gay rights, human rights, peace, environment, all these issues. But it also produced the neoliberals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in a way, these two, it was neoliberalism was a different kind of reaction to the state that said, let's have more market.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that, I think, Maastricht encapsulated that combination.
Yeah, and everyone says that about Maastricht, it had this lacuna where kind of civil states should have been, you know, who is going to make the political decisions if they no longer are, but it was that 68 spirit of not wanting those political decisions made in the same way.
Yeah.
It's really peculiar.
Luke, do you think it's reconcilable, the kind of the left vision for Europe and the right, or do you think we just need to obliterate the right?
Well, that wasn't the question that I was wanting to answer. Well, just to go back, maybe if I just say something about the origins first. I mean, I appreciate Ash's comments that we need to be alert to contemporary practices of colonialism and coloniality in the world we're living in. But I think if we tell part of the historical story, we can also uncover positives and negatives about the development of the European Union too. And as Mary has alluded to already, I mean, in the 1950s, there was this very strong sense that the European project was about the pooling of African colonies in particular. There's a great book by a couple of Swedish academics that I've read recently, and has really changed my thinking on this, so I'd encourage others to do, called Eurafrica. And this takes a term that was used actively in the 1950s, but it's completely slipped out of the official story of European integration, I dare say consciously so. And I mean the official story because I've also recently, in the work we're all doing, been to Brussels, as you do, and I've been to the Euro History Museum about the European Union that's very close to the European Parliament, and you can't find any of the history of Eurafrica there. And the Algerian War was central to crystallising and transforming Europe. It was a real case of something happening in Africa that transformed how we understood the European project. Because Algeria has this funny position in the history of being the only African state that was ever officially a member of the European Union. It was considered an indivisible part of the French Republic. It was nominally had equal citizenship rights. In practice, there certainly wasn't equal citizenship rights, and that's why we have the war. And what's interesting is that the post-independence Algerian state was very critical of the concept of Eurafrica, as you'd imagine, because they saw in it a way of European powers maintaining their colonial position as an overlord of the African states. But they did nonetheless seek to maintain the rights that they had in the European economic community as it was then. And that's where Europe starts to become defined as something that can't include Africa. After 1962, we get this notion that it's a European community. And this comes up again when Morocco applies to join the European Union in 1986, and it's told very flatly that it's not a European country. Now, I feel that we've taken something for granted here that we shouldn't take for granted, because if you look at the history of this region of the world over several thousand years, you can easily make a claim that the polities of North Africa are part of a political community that we could refer to in shorthand as Europe, but we completely accept that they shouldn't be. So all of that, as I agree, is completely contested all the way down in some ways, or at least the left-right stuff is contested. But actually, we haven't contested the concept of citizenship that is implied by excluding North Africa, even though this is so important to what's happening in the Mediterranean Sea, as you know, Niccolo Milanese in his book with Lorenzo Marsilis call it, the crisis of citizenship. If we have a conception of citizenship which is excluding people fleeing that region of the world from European citizenship, then it's raising this big moral and political question for us.
You want to come back on that?
I mean, I think just on this question of citizenship is that I think that this is something which the left has been incredibly timid on, and it pisses me off. It seems that we can only stretch as far as thinking, well, how many more refugees shall we take in? And it's still this like very deeply paternalistic approach to, you know, this idea of like what you bequeath citizenship and it's just a set of rights, but you fundamentally don't interrogate the logic of the border and you don't unpick the power to exclude. I think that one of the things that we should start thinking about, and this is sort of why lots of the Remain revolt arguments have left me feeling a bit cold is that it seems to me to have been mostly based around an institutional relationship to the European Union rather than thinking about our political selves or, you know, the myriad ways in which you can close distance between, you know, yourself and you know, sovereign political institutions. So I think one way to do it would be to think about how it would be possible to make a pan-European leftist case for mandatory citizenship, in which you have to take citizenship if you live here for more than however many years.
I just wanted to say something I've been wanting to change forever, because in the, assuming, you know, in the European Union, because the citizenship rights, which are quite limited, I mean, they're big in terms of moving around, but things like being able to vote in local elections or European elections are only given to citizens of nation states in Europe. And I've always thought that if it was just changed to residency, it would make an enormous difference to the European Union. You know, all those, what the French used to call sans-papiers, the people without papers, would suddenly have some sort of citizenship.
I mean, in the DNA of the European Union was a feminist agenda, and Ursula Hirschman's whole point was that borders are, as you say, paternalistic, but only a kind of patriarchal system can repudiate you. And the whole point of federalism was that your nation could, you know, having been a German Jew herself and having been cast out, only a nation can expel you, only a nation can exterminate you. And the whole point of a kind of federalist system would be you could no longer be expelled. And it was feminist in intent and also borderless.
I mean, I think that thing about only a nation state can expel you...
It turned out not to be true.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, you know, it's one of those ones where sort of history is like, sorry about that one. And so I think that's the thing, is that, like, there isn't a sort of magic wand of institutional arrangements which sort of make these power dynamics go away. And I think that that's, you know, part of the wishful thinking. And this is why I talk about that distance between us and sovereign institutions so much, is that we're not thinking about closing that distance. We're thinking of a different arrangement that's over there which will suddenly make everything better for us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's certainly not a project of renewed democratic engagement at all.
Can we move back to Maastricht?
John Giacomo, you're the person here who we blame for the passage of the Maastricht Treaty, right?
Well, before I accept this position as the defendant, I want to say something about migrations, to follow up the previous discussion. I think that colonization, and what is worst in the relationship between the North and the South, the haves and the have-nots, takes the form of discrimination in citizenship when the immigrants come, without facing the fact that, in fact, we need them. We need them. For many reasons. You know, in Italy, in which we have a wave of nationalist anti-immigrant feeling, we forget the fact that those who are on territory, those to whom we do not recognize citizenship, are in fact paying for a part of my pension right now. Because we are ailing as a population. So we can, and to bring it back to the essential aspect, those who are empowered in this moment use migration to start a sort of a war between the poor, setting the immigrants against those who are suffering, those who are the weak part of our society, those who are being discriminated at home. So I mean, any sort of left-wing social democratic perspective has to move from a positive relationship in terms of citizenship. I agree entirely with Mary's point. This is one of the priorities.
Yeah.
But I don't. I don't want to disappoint Luke. Must it came about? This is a very interesting fact, because there was a moment in which Maastricht was decided, September 1992, and the main challenge was the referendum that was going to take place in a Sunday in France, and where ultimately the yes had it, but by 51-52%, so it was extremely narrow. The days before, the Italian Senate was supposed to ratify Maastricht. If we ratified Maastricht, it was no news, and it ended up being no news. But had we not ratified Maastricht, it would have had an influence, perhaps a decisive influence, on the outcome of the referendum in France. The repetition of what happened in the 50s and that killed the European defense community. Now, the day in which we were supposed to vote, and we needed a quorum, because there was a large majority, because the moderate government was in favor, and we in the socialist opposition was also in favor, but we had to have the quorum, and there was an opposition of the extreme right and the extreme left. All of a sudden, the people of the government come to me and say, well, you know, we want to put this off, perhaps after the French have voted and so on. What will you in the opposition do? And I told them, you know, there are circumstances in which if you consult yourself, you know, you have a mandate already, but if you consult others, no way. So my reaction was immediate. I say we would take the flag of Europe and hit the government as hard as we can with the flag of Europe. But then I said, you know, I want to know why you're changing your minds. We are going to vote in 3 or 4 hours. And the answer was, I can quote chapter and verse and all this, pressure from the United States. It was the Bush government that didn't want a euro because they saw it as a threat against the hegemony of the dollar.
Yeah.
So I went to the extreme left, and I say, see that you are at the service of the American embassy. And so they stopped the opposition, and the thing passed. But what I want to draw your attention to, the political Europe is essential in terms of democratic representation of 500,000 people in this part of the world, in a phase in which we are moving, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, in a very dangerous and contradictory way towards multipolarity. So if we want a voice as citizens and extend that voice to the immigrants that come to Europe as citizens, it is absolutely essential that we get together. Which does not mean that we accept the European Union as it is today.
Yeah.
In which we have to acquire a democracy that does not exist and use the only democratic institution present but that has very little power, which is the European Parliament.
Can I just ask what multipolarity means?
Well, multipolarity as opposed to the previous situation in which you had a bipolarity between East and West.
I see, okay.
And that was extended to the rest of the world, so anybody in any country in the South had to choose, you know, between East and West. And by the way, the worst things happening in Afghanistan and in Libya come from the national governments, not from the European Union.
From the national governments of those countries, or from of
Europe.
Okay.
Of Europe and of the United States.
Mary, was there anything non-neoliberal, if you like, in Maastricht? Was there anything conceded that could have been about equality and social justice?
Absolutely. I mean, I look back, and I wanted to ask Gian Giacomo, because when I look back on 1954, when the defence community was defeated, I'm very glad it was defeated, actually, in retrospect, because I think then the tendency for Europe to become a super state would have been much stronger. And I, for me, it's very important that the European Union is some new kind of animal and not a superstate. And so I'm now looking back at Maastricht. And we were all at that time passionate Europeans. We were passionate Europeans because we'd been fighting against the Cold War. It was the first post-Cold War big event. And the new kind of discourse that emerged from immediately after the Cold War was about human rights, humanitarianism, civil society, all kinds of exciting things, including there being in Maastricht a social chapter, which, by the way, John Major refused to sign on Britain's behalf and did a deal that they would recognise Croatia and Slovenia as independent states in return for not having to sign the social chapter, a really nasty deal. And when Labour came into power, Robin Cook's first act was to sign the social chapter. So I just think I was terribly against the neoliberalism of the Blair government, but I think we let it go because we were so keen on all these other things. And I do think this is something for us to think about retrospectively. Should we have actually defeated that? Should we have actually been against Maastricht because it did build in this neoliberal system? And we were so keen on Europeanism and democracy and human rights that we were, at that time, both of us and all the people we knew for it.
Mary, let me add, when you speak of the new animal that we need, you know, to turn back to your question about multipolarism, you have China, you have Russia, you have the United States of Donald Trump at the moment. Now, Europe doesn't look very good, but in terms of a chance of a new animal that is for peace and not for war, for human security and not for military security, in terms of social rights, gender rights, and so on, Europe is frankly, of all these poles, the biggest chance we have. And you people here have a great role to play. Sometimes, you know, when I listen to your discussions, and of course, you know, Corbyn could do a little better. We would like a braver approach to this European relationship and so on. But I tell you, the privileged few are in a state of panic when they watch what you people are achieving and might still achieve by reversing a Brexit that was thought in terms of old-fashioned reactionary nationalism. people who had seen too many movies about the Second World War on television. There is another Britain. We need you now. We need you the way we needed you in 1939.
Oh, I've got so many feelings about Brexit. The way I see it is that 52% of the country voted to make 100% of the country unbearable. And that's why I'm in two minds about this whole democracy thing anyway. My thinking on Brexit has changed a lot in the past 2 years, because when I saw the result come through, I think it was undeniably driven by not just hostility to immigration, but hostility to what immigration represented. I was having a conversation with our esteemed Shadow Home Secretary, Diane Abbott, about this, you know, blurring between, you know, what it means to be an immigrant and what it means to be a brown person. And in her, like, wonderful Diane Abbott draw, she was like, Ash, they don't give a shit. They think I'm a migrant. They think you're a migrant. And they're talking about migrants. They're not talking about migrants. And so that's very true. This referendum was fought on immigration because there is a legitimate, you know, sort of tap for how many brown people you let in the country. But actually, it's about the brown people who are already here with citizens' rights, who represent a cultural and demographic threat. And this language of demographic apocalypse in Europe, particularly in Germany, also Netherlands and Belgium, I think is something that's only going to get stronger. And I think that that's something that the European project as it stands is actually quite comfortable with in terms of like a language of anxiety. And so that's where I was in 2016. I thought Brexit was only a vote in favour of racism, and that's all it could be. And I still think that, and I think this is my issue with the Lexiters, is that the issue of immigration sort of wanes and ebbs a little bit because people think they've already won. But I don't think that's the same as people moving in a more progressive or tolerant or accepting direction at all. However, where I sort of have changed my view across those 2 years is that I've spent the last 24 months trying to think about, well, you know, why did it go wrong? And I think one of the things is that you can't make an argument about, you know, the coming economic devastation to someone who's from Barnsley and economic devastation has been there for 40 years. That's something that's a hard argument to make. I think another thing that went wrong is to sort of say, well, the only rupture with the status quo that we will countenance is the one that we've decided already represents our values. That I think that that moment of rupture and that sense of, hang on, things aren't going to go the way that we've been told they should in the interest of stability is actually a very, very powerful thing. And I don't think that's an energy that the left can afford to neglect. I think that's something that we very much have to take on. And coming back to this idea of, like, so, you know, what does a radical case for the EU look like? Is that, I don't know. I don't know what it looks like. No one's telling me what it looks like. It, you know, the lay of the land as it is, it seems still like an argument for the status quo. I don't see that any of those pillars regarding transforming what citizenship looks like, or thinking about the way in which the free movement of capital makes us feel this overwhelming loss of control over our immediate lives, our economic lives, our neighbourhoods. And within that vacuum, I think we keep trying to hold that line of things as they are, and the case for how things can be different still seems to me to be very, very opaque, is that this notion of control being lost and that being inherently a racialised framing, I think, it's still there.
I mean, we hear this argument a lot, you know, oh, another Europe is possible isn't really for another Europe, it's just for this Europe. And I think we have to push back. I mean, we were at risk of all agreeing, so it's good that this has happened. So I think we need to push back on it a little bit. If you're a worker striking for a 3% pay rise, the left will always be behind you, and it won't tell you, hey, hang on a minute, you know what, you should really be striking for the nationalisation of your entire workplace, and you're not really thinking about how you can transform the capital-labour relation because you're only striking for a 3% pay rise. I mean, sort it out. I mean, yes, we're fighting what is somewhat a defensive struggle on Brexit because we want to build a transformative Europe agenda across Europe, and we're working very hard on that. But we also believe very strongly in the protection of the Europe that exists from the nationalist neoliberals that want to destroy it. And I think across the whole European Union, and we are, you know, building links through this conference and, you know, lots of, you know, events and campaigning, you know, over the next 12 months. I think this is just the beginning. But Brexit isn't a British problem or a British disease. I mean, it has British features in some of the, you know, warmed up colonial imperialist ideology is idiosyncratically British in some ways. But really, these debates are happening everywhere and all across Europe, and they're happening all across the left in Europe. And we need to, in that context, I think, build two alliances. One for the protection of democracy and the rule of law and human rights and the rights of minorities and no rolling back on the liberation agenda and the human rights agenda in Hungary and Poland and protection of women and so on. And another movement, and that's the so the first one is defensive struggle, and the second one is the transformative struggle, because we need to say, look, austerity has got to be thrown in the dustbin. You know, economic and monetary union can hopefully work, and it can be made to work, but only with radical reform, and that reform has to be progressive and it has to be left. And what I mean by that is that we have to make this really hard argument, but it's essential that the richer countries in Europe will have to pay more in to redistribute wealth progressively to the poorer countries of Europe, because otherwise the economic and monetary union just isn't gonna work. And that's a hard argument, but it's an argument that only the left can make. It's a uniquely left argument in this context.
Thanks to our guests, and thanks to you for listening. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, please tell someone about it, and better still, leave us a rating or review on your podcast platform. You can also feedback to us on Twitter @another_Europe, or find us on facebook.com/AnotherEuropeIsPossible. We'll be back in 2 weeks. See you then.